Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. I'm Peter Moore. Today we're heading back to the moment when a local Irish eccentric called Oscar became an international celebrity called Wilde. Oscar Wilde is one of the beloved authors of English literature. Like Orwell or Dickens or Austen, he seems to perfectly inhabit and epitomise the age that he represents. This, as the writer and academic Michelle Mendelssohn points out, was the age of Barnum, an era that rewarded the big, the bold, and the blustering. Today we know much about Wilde's spectacular and tragic fall in the 1890s, but what about the moment that made him? How exactly did he complete the metamorphosis from clever but directionless Oxford student to become one of the most recognisable figures in British cultural life? To answer this, Mendelssohn argues, we have to look to a particular year and to the United States of America. Michelle Mendelssohn is Professor of English and American Literature and a Tutorial Fellow of Mansfield College at the University of Oxford. She's author of several books on Victorian and modernist literature, and most recently, the acclaimed Making Oscar Wilde, which was a multiple book of the year and a semi-finalist for the 2019 Pen America Biography Prize. It's a superb book that tells a fascinating story about Oscar Wilde, race, and celebrity culture. Here's Michelle taking me on a travel back through time. Welcome to Travels Through Time. It's a real pleasure. I love the book. I think we're going to have some fun today with this because it's such a vibrant topic. But before we dive into it, I thought we'll start broadly. Can you just tell us a little bit about your interests as an academic and a teacher? And did these interests bring you to Oscar Wilde, or have you always been attracted to him as a literary figure and as a biographical subject?
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's great to travel through time with you and and your listeners, and especially to walk with Oscar Wilde through this podcast. I didn't come to this book and the writing of this book through Wilde specifically. I'd written another book on Wilde, but the thing that this book was going to be was a kind of look at race in the 19th century. And I was really interested in the intersection between sort of white supremacy in the US and this thing that we might want to talk about called Greater Britain, and just the intersection between the politics of whiteness. And the more I looked at it, the more I had Wilde's voice kind of echoing in my mind. And I became curious about his own politics, which everyone says are obscure. But what I wanted to discover is what he really thought about white supremacy. And that's kind of how I came to this.
And it's a book that, if anything, seems to have become more relevant in the time since it was published, because it came out a year ago, 2 years ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. It was originally published. And since then, there's been enormous interest in the question of race in the most kind of popular culture we have. And it's Oscar Wilde isn't actually the kind of character we associate immediately with these kind of discussions. Would you say that's a fair point?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I've given enough sort of readings and had enough people come up to me and say, you know, this isn't only about Oscar Wilde. They're kind of expecting some hagiography or some kind of celebratory account of the man. But I think it's possible to do that and also be true to this moment, which, as you say, is more and more resonant. And as I was writing it, Trump was just a distant, far off possibility, and he zoomed into focus as I was finishing the book. And so, yeah, the relevance of Wilde to this context was something that became more and more troubling as I wrote. And in a sense, what I was trying to show, and what I'm trying to show, is that people like Wilde who work in culture are also implicated in a kind of politics, either historically or, you know, sometimes in terms of what their work actually does in the world. So yeah, those are some of the things I wanted to explore.
I think it's just, you know, he was at Oxford at the same time as Cecil Rhodes, wasn't he? Is it, or maybe a little bit later. And it's just so interesting how we think about those two characters in completely different ways, although they were part of the same cultural moment in 19th century, which is one point. But we're going to get back to that later, so let's not stumble too deeply into that hole at the moment. I just wanted to ask one other question, which is a kind of preparatory one, I suppose, which is, you note right at the start of Making Oscar Wilde, and I should say at this point, I think it's a wonderful title because it's got that kind of, you know, pun. It's got a pun in it as well. You know,
Making Oscar Wilde, I do love which, puns,
which is very Wildean, I'd say. But we're living in the golden age of the archives. Could you tell us a little bit about how you used digital sources while researching Oscar's life?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was really the gift of being a digital native and growing up with Google and having all of these resources at my fingertips. It meant that all of those archival trips that it would have taken to you know, say Louisiana to dig up Wilde's, you know, uncle's family records, or to little known courthouses to dig up lynching records, or out of the way newspapers, all of those things I could access, you know, from my computer in Oxford. And I did make archival visits to various archives, but the bulk of the more obscure things were either on Google or in newspaper archive databases. And that, I just think, completely changes the landscape of what it means to do research and this kind of historical research now. So yeah, it was really exciting. And I do feel that we are living in the golden age of history, and particularly archival history.
Yeah, I'd agree with that completely. It's something I've found in my own work where, because we are accessing archives in such a different way through searches which can be very specific, you can suddenly dig up something which hasn't been seen by someone for so long, which might have been hidden at the bottom of a box or something like that. And in particular, you talk about a few discoveries right at the beginning of the book which were perplexing for you, and you could not unsee these images. Do you want to tell us what they were?
Yeah, it was at the William Andrews Clark Library in Los Angeles, sort of in a manila folder. There were these blackface pictures of Oscar Wilde, except I didn't know they were blackface because I didn't grow up in an era where blackface was part of popular culture. I grew up in French-speaking Canada, and I'm 43 years old, and blackface was not a part of the culture I knew. So I looked at this racist image of Oscar Wilde as a sort of plantation dandy, and the caption said, "The aesthetic craze, what's the matter with the nigger? Why, Oscar, you've gone wild." And I, you know, knew enough to know that there was a very bad word in there and that I didn't know anything more, so I just put it away. And at the same time, I just thought, this, as you say, you know, could not be unseen. I wanted to know what this was about. And so that's what led me to kind of uncover his racialized past.
And that past in particular is one that we can pinpoint in a chronological sense quite closely into this year of his American lecturing tour, which we'll get to very soon. But before that, I think we should really talk about the young Oscar a little bit. The vision that we have of him is very strong, and sometimes it's difficult to kind of get past the myth, I suppose. I mean, the very start of the book, you say this book tells the story of a local Irish eccentric called Oscar who became an international celebrity called Wilde. Shall we talk a little bit about Oscar's early life, maybe about his time at Oxford? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I mean, I think the first thing to say is that Oscar Wilde, even in death, is larger than life. And so people have a very fixed image of what he is. And that is, you know, as a terrific wit, as a terrific dandy, as someone who was born for success. And when you zoom back in time and you look at him at Oxford, you see that he's not at all those things. He might have those things kind of germinating away, but he's very much an average undergraduate. You look at the pictures of him and he's just a floppy, kind of outlandishly dressed young man. So his tweed suits are always louder than everybody else's. And when he first arrives, he has this Irish brogue that his English, you know, friends think is very eccentric and fun. But he quickly loses that because he realizes that the name of the game is sort of fitting in. He runs up huge bills in trying to fit in. So he does up his college rooms with blue and white china and peacock feathers and all sorts of kind of eye-catching things like that. And he's brilliant in tutorials. And one of the things I really emphasize in the book, and I think that's important to bear in mind, is he was brilliant in tutorials because he's an extremely clever young man, but also, and he didn't trumpet this, but also because he already had an undergraduate degree. He'd already, you know, graduated at the top of his class from university in Dublin. And so that really puts you at an advantage to anyone else you happen to be sitting in a tutorial with. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I wanted to track was these little ways in which the wild mythology is being built by trumpeting some things and silencing other things, like the fact that he had this edge.
So a few things that I just wanted to point out, and one of them is a physical thing, which is just how imposing a figure he was. He was 6'4" tall, which I think is, you know, kind of makes him stand out. As you say, he's just larger than life in so many different ways, but physically as well. He had a phenomenal memory, didn't he? And he could recite hundreds of lines of poetry without notes. Mm. I thought that's like kind of an interesting point to make at this point.
Having a phenomenal memory like Wilde's is also helpful when you want to sort of drop those, you know, those quotes in your speech and make yourself sound interesting at a dinner table. And people around you may or may not realize that those are not your own words. And so I feel like even in that, there's a kind of, you know, that good memory also leads to things like his plagiarism later on. But absolutely, you're right. He's a big guy. He's a smart guy. Yeah.
But he's also, and this is was a bit perplexing to me when I read it, he was also a lost soul, wasn't he? So when he graduated, he had what you might say a great aspiration in life, which he said success, fame, or even notoriety. But he didn't really have any practical idea of what he was going to do. So when he came out of Oxford with this, you know, double first in greats and, the Newdigate Prize, he didn't really have any direction, so he just loafed around for you. And it was quite funny to read in your book about, you know, this lost flower blowing around the society life in London, which is kind of what he wanted to do. And he was trying to become a tutor, and he was doing this and he was doing that. And it was only really that he was caught up in this moment of the aesthetic craze. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That
gave him some kind of definition and some direction.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, now we think of people graduating with a first from Oxford as being set up for life, but he wasn't, you know, and this great academic success gets kind of announced in all of the Irish newspapers, and it's quite a come down that, as you say, he's kicking around London not really knowing what to do. You know, he proposes himself sort of as a personal shopper and says he has great taste in neckties. You know, he's really at a loss until, as you say, aestheticism becomes a movement that he links himself to closely. And this is kind of through a stroke of luck, something quite miraculous, because he latches on to the painter James McNeill Whistler and one of the pretty women of the day, Lily Langtree, the actress. And so he's going to parties with them, and he's talking a lot about aestheticism while he's at these parties. And one of the caricaturists of the day, a man called George du Maurier, who's now better remembered as the author of a novel called Trilby. But George du Maurier sees Wilde and thinks, this young man is ridiculous, all of his art talk. I'm going to satirize him in, you know, one of the most popular magazines of the day, Punch. And it's through du Maurier's, you know, pen tip that Wilde becomes popularized as this flippity-floppity young man who has a lot to say about art and how it can enhance life, but is fundamentally a very silly, silly young man. Mm. So that's his first start, really.
And it is, it's almost, it's life imitating art right from the beginning with him, isn't it?
That's right.
I suppose. Okay, so hopefully that gives a bit of a picture of the characters at the heart of this episode. So now I'm going to ask you the question that I ask of everyone who comes on this podcast. It's a really fun question. And I think you're going to give us a fun answer. So if you could go back, if you could travel back through time to meet Oscar Wilde in any year in the past, which year would you like to choose?
I would love to choose the year 1882, which I think is the year of his making.
Right, okay. You actually make a really strong case for this at the start of the book. Even, and maybe, I was wondering whether Oscar realised the importance of 1882 himself, because he's famously quoted as saying, the two great turning points in my life were when my father sent me to Oxford and when society sent me to prison, which of course relates to a later period in his life that people know quite well. But in between those two dates sits the year 1882. So before we talk about what happened to Oscar in that year, do you want to just give a like kind of broad overview of what was going on in 1882? I know you say it was an electrifying year quite literally, because that's when Edison's electricity started sprouting out and lighting up houses and things. What was going on in 1882?
So it's, as you say, you know, the year of the first electric power plant. It's in Britain, the year we see the first electric tram, the first electrically lit theatre. So that's all very exciting. So while those lights are going on, though, there are lights, Victorian lights, that are going out. So it's also the year that sees the death of Darwin, of Emerson, of Garibaldi, you know, Longfellow, Rossetti, all of these names that we associate with the Victorian period. And then we also see the births of figures who will become prominent in what we think of as the culture of modernism and of the 20th century. So 1882 is the birth date of Virginia Woolf and James Joyce and Igor Stravinsky, painters like Georges Braque. And so I think to set Wilde in between those two kind of electrifying moments, both in terms of the technology, but also the arrivals and departures in terms of deaths and births, gives us a sense of what he's on the cusp of in that miraculous year.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, I mean, on the cusp quite literally, I suppose, because the year begins with him poised to start this American lecture tour, which we're going to follow him through. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the circumstances about how that lecture tour came about?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in a sense, the lecture tour comes about through Georges de Maurier's Punch caricatures, which I was talking about a moment ago, because they become so popular both in America and in England that American promoters think, well, you know, let's have this boy over. Let's have this boy over to entertain us. And so Wilde becomes kind of swept up in this culture of mass lecturing across the US, where you could basically bring anyone over from England or Ireland, and they would get some kind of interest from the audience. But
is this a lecture tour which was, sorry to interject, but I was wondering if it was influenced by Dickens's lectures, which had happened maybe a generation earlier?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Wilde certainly wants us to think that. He wants us to think that his lecture tour of the US is just like Dickens. And of course, you know, now, all right, but back in the day when he was a little nobody, there were not many stops set up. There were a few stops set up, and it was mostly a joke. And so the idea that he would go on to any kind of literary career or fame after this joke tour was certainly not part of what the promoters had been planning. But yes, Wilde, in his letters home, of course, spins it. You know, it's a good instance of kind of him building up his own mythology. And he says, you know, this is just like Dickens's tour. My audiences are massive. People are phoning. I can hardly down the streets anymore. That's not actually what's going on, as the book reveals.
As you say that, it reminds me that there's been a few figures in cultural history. I'm thinking particularly Bob Dylan and John Lennon have both spoken about how they had this sense of destiny very strongly instilled within them. Should we think the same when we think of Wilde? You know, this idea that even when they were obscure and unwanted, and I know at this point Wilde has also written, you know, quite an unsuccessful play, and no one's very interested. Mm-hmm. But has he got this sense that he is someone important, or do you just think he's maybe a bit more insecure than that, or is it difficult to say?
No, I think that's a great question, and it gets to the heart of who Wilde is, because he's been pumped up on, you know, to succeed from the cradle. His mother, you know, is a woman, an Irish patriot who loves high-flown rhetoric,
brilliant
and things.
Lady, yeah.
She was a brilliant woman, but she thinks she was destined for success and didn't quite make it for a variety of reasons. And if she didn't get it, she's hell-bent on her sons having it. And so Wilde, you know, has his moments of self-doubt, but in terms of what he puts out publicly, yes, I think he does feel like this is a date with destiny. And I think that begins to answer why we don't really know much about 1882 in Wilde's life, certainly not from his own pen, because a lot of horrible things happened to him that year. Mm. And he's a man who only wants us to remember the high points.
So let's go to your first scene then. Where would you like to go to first in 1882? On our pursuit of Oscar.
So on our pursuit of Oscar, I would like to take us to Chickering Hall in New York City, which is a big auditorium, on the 9th of January, which is Wilde's first American lecture.
I think this is Fifth Avenue. Okay, can you describe the scene? What would it be like if we were there? Give us a little bit of a description, please.
Yeah, so Wilde at this point has been in the US for almost a week. He's been completely made over, so he's absolutely gorgeous. He's nothing like the gangly undergraduate he was at Oxford. Now he's got a cape, he's got knee breeches that show off his legs, and he thinks, well, that's it, I'm done, I'm ready to give this lecture to thousands of people in this audience. The only thing he doesn't really have is a lecture. He's left that to the last minute because there's been so much to do around producing this kind of dashing young man.
Mm.
And so the lecture he gives to 1,200 people, who've each paid quite a lot, a dollar each, which is a lot in 1882, is this rambling A to Z about, you know, basically art from A to Z through the ages, everything you could ever want to know. Americans are bored because they came to be entertained. And then also they just don't understand what he's saying. They have trouble with his accent. Also, he's mumbling. So all of the ideas we have of Wilde as someone who commands the stage just are exploded by this first performance, which is terrible.
Yeah, there's a interesting quote you have, I think, from this. What's the name of the kind of tour manager, I suppose I should, he's Colonel.
Oh, Colonel Morse, yes.
Colonel Morse, yeah. He begs him up and he says he walks on stage and within 5 minutes, everyone's transfixed. And then you realize that that's actually just mythologizing what happened. And really, it wasn't the case. I was really intrigued to read that at this point in history, it was actually Americans who had the better reputation as public speakers in comparison to the British, at least, and maybe the Irish as well. So maybe they had a higher expectation than what they got. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the Irish certainly have that reputation for being terrific storytellers. And if, you know, Wilde was being promoted as an Englishman, which is a strange thing, which we might want to talk about, but anyone who suspected he was Irish would have also expected that he could speak much better than he could. In some senses, it's not surprising, because impressing people in Oxford tutorials or in, you know, your Dublin University classroom is not the same thing as holding an audience of 1,200 in the palm of your hand. And just going back to what you were saying about Dickens, you know, Dickens had practiced before a mirror. He had wanted to be an actor as a young man. Dickens had all of these things that helped him make his own reading tours a tremendous success, not to mention that, you know, he already had this huge following and people had read his books. Wilde had no practice. He had no following. So any comparison to Dickens is really, I think, spurious.
Yeah, but it's interesting as well to think about this point in the development of culture when having this public persona for a writer is, or in Wilde's case, it would be a playwright as a poet, it's becoming increasingly important, isn't it? So I think of Dickens maybe, but even in the realm of science, you have people like John Tyndall will pack out lecture theatres for their experiments. Mm. And it seems that Oscar's almost gone to, I mean, what usually happens is these people at the end of their career will develop a bit of a sideline
and it's, I suppose, the equivalent of the TED Talk today or something. But Oscar's gone straight to the TED Talk without really having the career first. Is that the feeling, maybe?
I love that analogy. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And in a sense, you know, Oscar's father was a precursor for this TED Talk format, because his father had basically, you know, traveled around Egypt and Tenerife and, you know, all sorts of interesting places, but then written a book, and he was being invited to talk about, you know, all sorts of things, you know, related to that. And he could have made a career as a kind of public speaker in that way. And I think what you say about science is important, because, you know, there was no TV, there was no podcast. And so people are getting their information about the world through a variety of sources, some of which are, you know, public lectures, some of them are, you know, public entertainments also. So yeah, it's really fascinating.
I should also just clear up another point, which is one that a lot of people will know as a touchstone of Wilde's American tour, and maybe we can clear it up quite quickly. Did he, when he walked off that ship, say, "I proclaim my genius," or what it was? I'm not sure the exact quote. Do you know?
Yes, I'm always tempted when I have go to customs and they say, "Do you have anything to declare?"
I have no.
Yes, apparently he said, "I have nothing to declare but my genius." Yeah. But what I found out, thanks to the research of another Wild scholar, is actually the first record, you know, the first note we have of this thing he supposedly said is years later. I think it's even after Wilde's death. So, you know, there's a real industry in Wilde witticisms. If you Google, you know, Wilde quotes online, it's amazing the things he supposedly has to say about Kim Kardashian. It's very impressive, but it's also not true.
Yeah. Oh, well, maybe next time when we're in that, you know, massive arrivals hall, you're not really in the mood to be witty by the time you get to the desk, so are you? Okay, all right.
They're too scary, yes.
Very formidable. Okay, so a bit more mythology for us there, but I suppose I should ask you, if we're going to characterize this lecture as a failure, and you know, people are disappointed, they go away, they paid a lot of money, they've had this hyped up intellectual talk to them in a way which is quite incomprehensible, what happens in the days after?
So what happens in the days after is that there's a kind of whirlwind of negative publicity that starts to surround Wilde. And so there starts to be positive coverage from people who are willing to continue to listen to him respectfully. But there also starts to be very negative news coverage. And this news coverage is also very racialized. And I think that's something that hadn't, you know, that people don't really think about in relationship to Wilde. Also because when we think about the Irish, you know, today, the Irish are not as racialized today as they would have been back then. But back then, to be Irish in the United States was to be on one of the lowest rungs of society, alongside newly freed Blacks, people who were only recently being called African Americans and who were only recently citizens. And so Wilde is being portrayed increasingly in the news coverage after those first lectures as a monkey, as the wild man of Borneo, and eventually as a blackface minstrel, because of his Irishness, but also because he's a fool, they think, just spouting all sorts of art nonsense.
Okay, this is, the population of New York is about 1.2 million at this point, and a century earlier it had been about 20,000, which gives you the sense of the population explosion that's happened there. And in a way, it struck me that this journey he's taking to America is mimicking the journey of so many thousands of Irish migrants at that time. And it is really interesting to place his story alongside theirs. And I suppose it does illuminate the kind of prejudice that that Irish people would be subject to then.
I think what you've just said, the way you framed it, is really gets to the heart of his experience. Because if we can begin to imagine Wilde not as destined for greatness in that moment, but just as a young Irishman going over to America to see if he can make his luck there, then yeah, he does fit into this moment where the huddled masses are, you know, arriving in America, and you know, you get this huge influx of Chinese and Jews and Italians and Greeks and Irish. Wilde is one of those faces in that moment. Yeah.
How does he respond to this? Is he used to such public I suppose it's almost like being shamed in public, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's there again. I think we need to sort of extract ourselves from our current moment of identity politics where, you know, you think of everything is so racialized, particularly in this moment as we record this, you know, at this moment. But Wilde is not used to this negative portrayal. And growing up with the mother, the brilliant mother he had, who, you know, was a fervent Irish nationalist, being Irish was something positive. So it's quite a mental change in his mental kind of outlook to think, right, okay, I was on top of a heap across this, on this side of the Atlantic, and now supposedly they want to put me on the bottom of the heap on this side of the Atlantic.
But it's interesting as well that, I mean, there's a subtlety within his own Irish heritage, isn't there? Because he's part of the ascendancy, really, in Ireland. So a lot of the prejudice, I would imagine, was directed against Catholic Irish migrants. And in a way, from his beginning, he's been of like a different identity to that. Is this a fair point, would you say?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you got it exactly right. And I think that kind of chameleon-like quality that he has, you know, he's lopped in with Irish Catholics, you know, for Americans who don't really care to hear about the ascendancy or don't really care about nuances about Protestantism. But then, you know, his father had certainly not dissuaded people of thinking that the Wildes were Catholics when it suited the family. And so I think this chameleon-like nature is a bit kind of built into Wilde's DNA, in the sense that he's always kind of ducking and diving and trying to adjust to whatever will get him ahead in society.
I think so. Well, I mean, in the book, there's lots of images in the book which actually trace your journey through the archives and show just how he was depicted in places like the Washington Post. And it's absolutely striking and quite shocking in some ways. And I can see why they were so provoking when you first came across these images. So I think we'll leave that moment there and go to your second scene, because this builds on what happened at the start of January. Where would you like to go to next?
I would like to go to Walt Whitman's house in Camden, New Jersey, on the 18th of January, 1882.
Walt Whitman is someone who I only really know in outline. He's another of these people who turns up in books of quotations. Obviously, he's a poet. Could you tell us a little bit more about Walt Whitman and probably why Wilde would be enticed to go and visit him?
Walt Whitman now, I think, would be a name familiar to any American listener. But at the time, in the 19th century, he was really known as a poet of sex, basically, as someone who wrote poetry about something that was referred to as Greek love, so the kind of homosexual overtones, but also about the totality of man. And some people celebrated this, and a lot of people thought this was improper reading. Wilde's mother thought it was a great book for her and young Oscar to read together when he was 11 years old. She got one of the earliest copies of Leaves of Grass, which gives us a sense of, you know, how avant-garde that family was. But I think Wilde, in going to visit Whitman, really wants to pay homage to this by then quite old poet who he had read as a young man. But he's also looking for a kind of role model as a gay man, maybe even as a bisexual man, of someone who kind of knows what it's like to have urges to love people in ways that aren't discussed in the 19th century very much.
What do we know about their meeting? Is it well documented?
It is and it isn't, that meeting, and I think that's why I wanted us to go there.
Okay, well, we could find out what happened, I suppose, then.
Yeah, I mean, so we can, I tried very hard to find out exactly what happened. And one of the reasons it's so difficult is that they don't, neither Whitman nor Wilde, allow a journalist to come and just sort of witness the meeting. Instead, they both give separate interviews afterwards, which is brilliant in terms of PR. You know, it's twice the PR. But they also say conflicting things. And Wilde says that the kiss of Whitman is still on his lips, which, as you can imagine, you know, American journalists still have a field day with. And Whitman says that they drank wine together. So, you know, you put those two things together and yes, people's minds were racing as to the possibilities.
Is it also being characterized probably quite cleverly by Oscar here as a bit of a passing of the torch moment? So yeah. Here's the young, clever poet meeting the wise old. He's got a big beard, hasn't he, Whitman?
He does. So in the sort of frontispieces to Leaves of Grass, to Whitman's poems, he's still using this rather sexy open-shirted picture of himself, but yeah, by then he's an old man with a big beard, more of a sort of Santa Claus looking kind of man, and while definitely is going to pay homage, but also to say, okay, can I be your successor? And Whitman is not so keen. I mean, he gives Wilde a really hard time, which is interesting and maybe not so surprising. But in the end, Whitman, you know, does sort of say that Wilde is not such a bad fellow after all.
This is... I want to introduce this character called Colonel Higginson, I think he's called, because he seems to be one of the people who's most scandalized by the insinuations that come out of this meeting. You say, oh, the kiss of Whitman still on my lips, etc. It's obviously come on the tails of this lecture, which has generated, even though it's negative, it's generated a lot of publicity. And in that sense, this is another Wildean thing. It's, you know, the worst thing is not to be talked about at all. At least people are talking about him, even if it's in a negative sense. And one of the most scandalized is this Colonel Higginson. Can you tell us a little bit about him, please?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought him up, because he was one of my kind of favorite bad guys in the book when I was writing it. So Higginson has this amazing military career where he leads the first all-black regiment during the American Civil War, and now he's sort of faded into obscurity, but he was very, very famous in his own day, and is perhaps most famous in our day for having helped Emily Dickinson publish her first poems. But anyway, Dickinson has very clear ideas about what it is to be a man, and to his mind, people like Walt Whitman and Oscar Wilde are not real men, and he has a whole catalogue of reasons for that. And so he really takes against both of them. And what was interesting, I found, was that Higginson actually watches Oscar Wilde graduate from Oxford. He's in the audience at the Sheldonian. And so he sees him go from being this young undergraduate to this moment where he's knocking on Walt Whitman's door in New Jersey, in a sense. And so Higginson is a kind of eyewitness to Wilde's kind of transformation. But Higginson certainly doesn't like the direction things are taking. He, to him, this is not where, you know, manhood or art or poetry should be going.
Yeah, so he writes about it in quite a caustic, vicious attack, calling that uncanny manhood. I should also, I just remembered now, and I have to bring this up because it was such a wonderful image, that there was a plan, which very sadly for history, did not come to pass, when Oscar and Walt Whitman were to ride in an open top carriage through the streets of Philadelphia, and I think that was called off because it was January and Walt Whitman didn't want to go outside or something like that. It's a bit too cold, but you can see what's happening at this moment, in the sense that they are testing, like, kind of the edges of what it is and what's acceptable to be a man. Is that right?
I think that's right, and testing ways of being seen also. I mean, just as there are so many publicity stunts that feel so fresh and modern, like the one you've just talked about. I mean, it's, and when you think about, you know, that the plan was for them to meet in Philadelphia, you know, the city of brotherly love, it just brings out the kind of Greek love element as well. And I think some of these models for what it is to be a man, whether straight or gay, you know, didn't exist in the 19th century. And so this increases the kind of enigma around Oscar Wilde. And in a sense, it served his purposes, because, you know, Americans want to know what he is. And so maybe they'll buy a ticket and come to his lectures, which is what he wants. So, yeah, no stunt is too low, it seems.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. It also strikes me as well that we are now, because we talked a few months ago to the Shakespearean scholar, James Shapiro, who you might know. And he told us about, we talked about the year 1845 and Manifest Destiny. But at that point, it was still very much a case that Americans would be coming over to Britain to have their reputation confirmed. It strikes me now that we're, I don't know if something's changed or if this is just a new kind of, you know, cultural moment, but it seems that the reverse is now in process. People from Britain are going over to America, which is obviously something we're much more familiar with today, from Piers Morgan to James Corden to Heather. We don't always export the best, but we export them nonetheless. And do you think this is the start of that? A bit?
It's interesting to see it in that way. And I think, you know, as a, from a kind of, from the perspective of literary culture, I think one thing I would say is that the type of journalism that Americans are producing and reading, even in the 19th century, is nothing like the journalism that's being produced over here. You know, American journalism is, in Oscar's time, is all about the details. You know, how do you like to trim your nails? How do you like your eggs at breakfast? You know, British journalism comparatively is very staid. And so, yeah, I think you can see in embryo the beginnings of those careers you've just mentioned happening in 2020. Yeah.
Hello, Peter here. As you know, at Travels Through Time, we work in partnership with the visual historian Jordan Lloyd of Colourgraph. Over the past few months, Jordan has been creating some fascinating colourised prints to go alongside our episodes. One of them, for example, is a completely new image of the four smiling Beatles in Washington, D.C. at the moment their fame was about to explode in America. He's also colourised a poised, suspenseful photograph of Fidel Castro at the United Nations in 1960. Now, for this episode, he's created an absolutely compelling image. It shows a highly stylized Oscar Wilde at the beginning of his 1882 lecture tour of the United States. Now, it's a photograph you've probably seen before, a snapshot of the young artist at the moment of his emergence as a cultural force. But to see it colorized with all the reds and the greens and the texture of the carpet really is something else. You can also see Wilde holding his own book of poetry, something he's obviously very, very proud of. To see it, head to our episode page at tttpodcast.com or to Jordan's site, colourgraph.co, where you can buy a fabulous print of it as well. Travels Through Time listeners get 10% off any of their orders there. Just enter the discount code TTT at the checkout.
Well, all these stunts, really interesting, but I think the third scene is perhaps the most surprising. So do you want to tell us where it is? Where would you like to go for your third scene, please?
Yes. So for my third scene, I thought the obvious place would be to take people to Wilde's trial. So I decided not to do the obvious thing. And I thought I would take people to the most surprising place, which is Biloxi, Mississippi, to the home of Jefferson Davis, who would have been president of the Confederate United States, had the American South won the Civil War. And Wilde goes there on the 27th of June.
And he says, I think, at one point, that he is the man he would most like to meet in all of America, which was very surprising to me. Could you maybe explain why Wilde was so motivated to meet this figure who, to many, was a bit of a laughingstock, I suppose?
Yeah. So I think there were two things going on there. At first, when I read about this meeting, I thought, well, here's another publicity stunt. You can't take this seriously. Wilde is, you know, has gone to the southern United States and he's just going to visit Jeff Davis, this white supremacist, for the news headlines, I thought. But then the more I read, the more I realized, actually, Wilde is taking this very seriously. And Wilde is saying loads of admiring things about Davis. He's reading Davis's writings, and he's comparing the cause of Ireland, you know, in 1882 to the cause of white supremacy before the American Civil War. And that's when I really sat up in my chair and started paying attention, because it seems that this is a bit of a pilgrimage, sort of like the pilgrimage to Walt Whitman. you know, by then, Jeff Davis is a military icon, but he's a failed military icon. He, you know, famously ends his so-called heroic Civil War career by trying to escape and being captured wearing his wife's coat and shawl. And so people think, oh, here's another, you know, effeminate man. So I think Davis is someone that Wilde wants to connect to in terms of his politics, but also there's still that kind of element of Wilde trying to capture a way of being a certain type of man.
Do we know what happened at this particular meeting?
Yeah, so this meeting is interesting because what happens is that Davis is completely uninterested in Wilde. Davis is 74 years old, but he has a very pretty young daughter who's 18 years old, much closer to Wilde's age. She's very clever. She's very interested in the Irish. She's very interested in art. And so I think there's another thing going on here, which we don't often think about in relation to Wilde nowadays, because he's such a big gay icon. But, you know, American girls and American young women were very interested in him, and he was a very eligible bachelor. And I think it's quite possible that, you know, there are romantic overtones to this visit going on.
So if people are interested in reading about it, where would they go? Where is it documented?
It is mostly the newspapers and then in his interviews. It's documented in a book called Oscar Wilde in America, The Interviews. And it's a collection of interviews edited by Matthew Hoffer and Gary Scharnhorst. And it's in those these interviews that Wilde begins to say, you know, that he's reading Davis and that he wants to visit him and what a pleasant time he had.
It's almost part of a pattern, I think you point out, that he is reacting against these rumours of his effeminacy and anti-Irish racism by trying to align himself with these characters who are in inverted commas real men. So your miners in Colorado and Jefferson Davis and figures like that. So it's always interesting to consider at this point how much is promotional material and how often he's trying to just kind of make a splash, but how much he's like having some kind of interior dialogue with himself about his own identity. I suppose that's the heart of your inquiry, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think this, you know, this meeting with Jefferson Davis might have begun as a publicity stunt, but it certainly ends up as anything but. It crystallizes his belief in the similarity between the cause of the South in the U.S. Civil War and Ireland. And he says, you know, the cause of the Southern U.S. in the Civil War was like the cause of Ireland today. It is a struggle for autonomy and self-government. So he really sees it not at all from a slave's perspective. And now we think of Wilde as someone who is very free-thinking. You know, it's a bit surprising to see how conservative he would have been.
The obvious question after that is that because we are living at a time of maybe revising our opinions of figures in the past, and this goes across like kind of so many different eras and you know, kind of theatres of history, we're looking at them and holding them to a different benchmark or a different standard, and you might say that's fair, it might not be, but Oscar Wilde has never really been someone who I've noticed has been like brought into this process. But at the same time, we see here very clearly that, and you write that his idea of whiteness, it turns out, was not very far away from that of the Confederacy's idea of whiteness. And it's a kind of extra dimension that perhaps, I don't know, has it been explored and I've missed it? Or is this quite fresh, do you think?
I think it's a super niche of Wilde's history and criticism. So I think it is something that... listen, people have spent so many decades trying to build up Wilde. I think that this rather shameful family history that the Wilde family has is not one that any Wilde scholar or indeed the Wilde family would want to showcase. But I think one of the things that's worth remembering is, Wilde's uncle, his maternal uncle, was a plantation owner. He had a slave plantation with 515 slaves. He fought for the Southern Confederacy during the war, and he designed the Confederate flag for the state of Louisiana. That doesn't make Wilde himself a bad or racist writer, but it does mean that there's a kind of cultural context for Wilde understanding the Irish cause as part and parcel of the kind of Southern American cause. There's a family history there.
That is really fascinating. It's something to dwell on. I think I can't let you go without letting us go a little bit further through the year. I know we've looked at these three specific events. Each one brings out a different aspect of the lecture tour and of Wilde's character, and they will of course like filter through later on in his life. And if you want to read about that, you've got the book to go to. But I should say, how does the year finish off? How does the lecture tour conclude?
So the way the lecture tour ends is indicative of all of the paradoxes and the fake news and the falsities that will have dogged Wilde throughout the year 1882. So it ends on the American side of the Atlantic with a fake news report saying that Oscar Wilde has been hung in effigy, that he has been lynched. Wilde sails across the ocean, and on the British side of the Atlantic, people are saying he's a great success, he's had terrific audiences at his lectures, he's made a ton of money, he's now ready to get married, his mother is even a bit afraid that she won't recognize him. So in a sense, everything that happened in America he wants to put behind him, and this is really the beginning of Wilde's ascent into the great character we now know.
It's such a fascinating period of history, and you go into it in wonderful detail in the book. It's kind of a lively narrative, which is punctuated with all of these characters that people might have heard of as well. But before we come back to 2020, I'm going to ask you the inevitable question that comes at the end of the podcast. If you could bring one tangible object back to have with you today from 1882, from our kind of pursuit of Oscar, what would it be?
I love this question so much because there is one tangible object that I was desperate to find, that I did my darndest to find, and I never could find, and that is Oscar Wilde's coat. When he arrives in the US, he gets this amazing fur coat, and he wears it throughout the lecture tour. It's his constant companion, and it sees him through all of the highs and lows. He comes back to Britain with it. He has it throughout his whole career, and then it disappears. And when he's down and out and he really needs money, he writes a letter to his brother saying, where's the coat? Where's the coat? Can you sell the coat? Can you, get me some money? And the brother sells the coat, I think, and the coat just disappears, and Wilde sees none of the money. But I wanted to find that coat, and I wish we could have that coat, because I sort of felt like...
If we're looking out for a coat on the streets of London today, we'd be looking for...
Yes! A fur coat with the label Oscar Wilde sewn into the collar, please.
Okay, I'm going to have a look in my local coffee shop. There's some good coats in there. Listen, this has been so much fun. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners will have done too. It's, a really interesting character, one of the best characters to follow, but also the context of America at that point in their national development. It is really interesting. To put the two of them together has been really, really enjoyable.
So, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Peter. This is so much fun.
Exactly. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
That was me, Peter Moore, talking to Michelle Mendelssohn about her fascinating book, Making Oscar Wilde. It's recently available in paperback from Oxford University Press. As you'll have heard midway through our interview, Jordan Lloyd at Colourgraph has made the most striking and provoking colourised image of Wilde to go alongside this episode. It's a well-known studio shot from his sessions with Napoleon Cerroni, taken shortly after he arrived in New York in 1882. You might know the photograph already, but the colours that have been hidden inside it for more than a century will be completely new to you. It's a blaze of reds and greens, and if you want to see it for yourself, head to our episode page on tttpodcast.com. It's a real treat. I hope you enjoyed this episode, which was great fun to make. We'll be back with more next Tuesday, but from me for now, that's it. Thank you very much for listening.